through listening, talked about developing insight through reflective thinking, reflective investigation, and developing insight through practice or cultivation. I think it's really important to sort of absorb and honor those three ways of learning, and I'm not just talking about conceptual learning here, those three ways of learning and understanding the teaching. You know, we usually present a weekend like this as a study practice retreat. Study's probably really not the best word, you know, because many of you here have got, you know, histories of studying, and they may not all have been pleasant histories. You know, and often when we think about studying, we think about memorizing information, absorbing information, and then somehow being able to do something with that information. And we often think about it really primarily as a kind of cognitive function. So study is not the best word. I think this is a sort of contemplative inquiry. A contemplative inquiry. When I talk about those three ways of understanding, three ways of developing understanding, in the Buddhist teaching, there isn't a hierarchy in these three ways. You know, it's not like, oh, the form of practice and the form of cultivation is somehow better or more valuable than the reflective thinking and the listening to the teaching. The Buddha always started with this listening to the teaching. This is where we actually get sort of shifts in perspective. This is where we get the information that there may be ways of seeing, ways of living, ways of understanding that don't already exist within our current framework. And, you know, I know in my own practice this was an incredibly significant piece. You know, I don't know how it is for you, but you know, I went to Asia when I was 17 to begin practicing. And what was startling to me was this completely radical worldview held within the community I was studying and learning in that was so very, very different from the worldview that I had grown up in. You know, growing up in northern Canada, you know, I lived within a culture where, you know, it was quite normal to kill anything that annoyed you. It was kind of like normal. It had never occurred to me this might not be a good idea, you know, or that it might be questionable, or that annoyance could be handled in a different way other than annihilating the things that annoyed me. You know, that was like a totally new piece of information. It was a totally new piece of information that maybe, you know, rage and greed were somewhat questionable things. You know, and you think about it in our culture, you know, the ways that, you know, well, not just in our culture, in our world today, the ways that hatred has become normalized, you know, or that greed has become almost normalized. You know, to actually hear the information that there may be a freer, kinder, more compassionate way to live is really, you know, it can be a life-changing piece of information. You know, if we actually absorb that and digest that and reflect upon it. So listening was always very central. You know, and if you remember at the time of the Buddha, you know, the ethos at that time of the Buddha, you know, 2,600 years ago in India, life was pretty tough, you know, and pretty difficult. It was about, from the majority of people, about survival, you know. And so the spiritual ethos at that time was very much about how to sort of transcend this life and this world that was so problematic and so distressing. You know, so most of the spiritual practices at that time were about, you know, mortifying the body, subduing the mind, looking at ways to sort of dissociate and disconnect from the world around people, just simply to find the exit route, you know, about how to get out. And that can sound like a very sort of dated you know, dated strategy, but I don't think it's actually all that different in our world today. You know, how many people find themselves really looking for strategies and avenues to disconnect from what is, to dissociate from the difficult and the challenging and the painful. You know, it is why we have an epidemic of self-harm, you know, of addiction, of ways to somehow annihilate the difficult. So the Buddha was quite radical in his time in suggesting, you know, that the end of distress, the end of struggle, and the end of confusion could really be found in the midst of this life, with its lovely and its unlovely, its easeful and its challenging. And this was, in his teaching, really a new piece of information for people who were really dedicated to understanding and dedicated to freedom, to turn towards life as it is. And in the midst of that, in the midst of that classroom, to develop the capacities and the qualities that allowed for liberation, that allowed for compassion. So this listening piece is actually so significant, because without it, we're often operating in our lives in a kind of closed feedback loop system, aren't we? About what we know, and how that knowing is informing our choices and our sense of possibility. It occurred to me last year, I watched the, I'm sure there's a lot of Apple fans here, so please don't be offended, but I was watching the Steve Jobs movie, and I was sort of so taken with the idea, this commitment to, you know, to having a complete closed sort of system, you know, no plugins. And I thought, no, we need plugins. You know, we need plugins. We need plugins to kind of keep offering us some sense of what we don't know. What we don't know, to actually learn from what we don't know, rather than simply operating on the tracks of what we know and what works for us. Now, yeah, we came from a generation of teachers, you know, where when we started teaching in the West, our primary concern was on, you know, establishing retreat environments, offering, you know, formal, sustained meditative retreats where people could deepen in their practice. And I think we have done and are continuing to do a fairly good job in that. But I think the downside is that I think we probably communicated a message that was not always helpful for people. And I think the, you know, and don't misunderstand me, you know, don't come to think that I don't deeply value formal practice and inner development, because I certainly do. But I think the piece of, maybe the message that wasn't so helpful was to kind of prioritize and value formal practice over everything else, over reflective listening and reflective thinking and listening. You know, because so often I come across people who think, well, I just need to sit more. You know, that's going to be the answer. You know, I just need to sit more. And, you know, thought is somehow an obstacle to that inner development. And it's easy to dismiss kind of reflective thinking as the sort of intellectual stuff. And over here we have the experiential stuff. Whereas actually, certainly in the Buddha's teaching, he so much encouraged this reflective thinking about how to think in a reflective way, in an investigative way. And I think this hasn't always been part of our education, you know, about how to do that. We've learned to think in very good ways, helpful ways, obviously. But to think in reflective ways, where we think without actually knowing the answer, or without demanding an answer or a certainty, to be able to reflect in a way that takes us into new ways of understanding. So there isn't, you know, this is very much a false dichotomy, I think, is what I'm trying to say, between formal cultivation of the pathway and reflective thinking. I think it's very, very helpful for us to bring these together and to value the capacity of our minds to probe and to delve and to consider without actually trying to prove something or, you know, come up with some kind of certainty. Developing insight through practice, that's one way of putting it. We cultivate stillness, we cultivate a sustained observation of the inner processes of our bodies and minds. We come to understand some very kind of core elements of that really do bring and deliver a certain amount of freedom, you know, in terms of understanding the nature of change, understanding the origins of struggle and confusion. We start to understand the patterns that lead to distress and what leads to the end of distress. These are really important insights that we really come to see really in the classroom of our own body-mind experience. There's another piece here which is equally important, which is to recognize that insights are something that we practice. That insights are not just, you know, moments of revelation. They're not kind of a moment of experience that we have on a cushion or on a walking path and then we sort of put in the cupboard or in the closet somewhere and hope that they're going to help us at some point when they're really needed. Insights are actually something we practice. When we know what leads to confusion, we actually practice that insight. When we understand the nature of change and uncertainty and instability, we actually practice that insight in the sense that we learn to apply it and to embody it and to kind of make that understanding so central in our life. I think this whole word insight, which, you know, has become so naturalized in our community, is at the same time kind of shrouded in a certain amount of mystery. You know, people, we practice in an insight tradition, you know, we talk about insight meditation, and then we kind of, you know, sometimes sit back and think, well, what are the insights we're meant to be happening? You know, what do they look like? You know, how do we know if we've had one? You know, what do we do with it if we have had one, you know? And there's often a certain kind of embarrassment about, you know, if somebody asked you, you know, well, what are the insights you've really come to? You know, well, you know, there might be a little kind of reservation about sort of actually formulating that or articulating that. But I think what is so significant in this teaching is that if understanding is to mean anything, it's because it changes us. It's because it changes how we live, because it changes how we relate, because it changes how we see the world and how we see ourselves. And that insights require practice. Understanding requires practice. You know, I might have an insight, you know, that metta or kindness is really an effective way of bringing conflict to an end. But if I don't practice that in moments of conflict, it doesn't actually mean very much, does it? Just kind of like a good idea, felt like a really good idea at the time, and now something else feels like a good idea. So we learn to practice insights, and certainly in this path and this weekend when we explore this third ennobling truth, nibbana, the end of unsatisfactoriness, the unshakable liberation of the heart, I'm going to really encourage you not to think of this as some sort of remote aspiration or remote goal, but perhaps as an understanding that we actually do practice in our lives.